In our next case this morning, 2022-1401, Epcon Community Franchising LLC versus Wilcox Development Group LLC. Good morning. On behalf of the appellant, Ms. Carwile.
Chief Justice Kennedy, may it please the court. I'm Tiffany Carwile here on behalf of the appellant, and I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for a rebuttal. The issue in this case is straightforward. Does the Fair Housing Act preempt Ohio's contribution statute? Both the law and the equities show that it is not. First, allowing state contribution does not conflict with or create an obstacle to the enforcement of the FHA. Second, there is nothing equitable about allowing multiple entities to contribute to the alleged housing violations, but only one entity being held responsible. The FHA supports holding everyone involved in the process accountable. And importantly, the defendants do not disagree. At no point in this case, at the motion to dismiss stage, in the 10th District, or in the briefing to this court, does the defendant claim that the FHA preempts Ohio's contribution statute. Rather, the trial court sua sponte ruled that Ohio's law is preempted without briefing from either party, and then the 10th District compounded that problem by applying the wrong analysis. The correct analysis here starts with a presumption against preemption, but the 10th District turned this presumption on its head when it held that if Congress had wanted to provide a right for contribution, it would have included such a right.
Assume we agree with you. What do we do about this issue that's kind of in the background, but is really the big issue of whether or not there is a right to contribution under the statute at all, whether or not someone who's liable under the Fair Housing Act is a joint tortfeasor?
Your Honor, first I would say that this court should address the preemption issue because the 10th District's decision was such a precedent-setting decision and applied the law incorrectly, and that a lot of the state agencies, or almost all the state agencies and elected officials, their cases come up through the 10th District, and their decision could apply to more than just the FHA, and because it held that if there's not a reciprocal federal right of action, then the law is preempted, and that's not the analysis. So this court needs to address that. Second, with regard to the alternative grounds raised by the defendants, our position is none of those have merit.
Should we address them? I mean, it's kind of like the, I think Justice Alito asked a question at oral argument, which was something like, assume a centaur smokes 10 packs of cigarettes a day. Well, you know, will he get lung cancer? I mean, there's this underlying issue there that seems fairly important.
Your Honor, the appellant's position is that for the sake of judicial economy, this court should address those issues.
But it really hasn't been fairly briefed, right? I mean,
both parties have briefed it in this case, so I think the court has the briefing on it. Ultimately, it is at the court's discretion whether they take and consider those alternative grounds, but the appellant's position is that the court can consider those and should, and that none of them have merit, and so that the whole case should be reversed, remanded back to the lower courts. Going back real quick to the preemption issue, nothing in the FHA requires or has a finding that it should be preempted. There's no express preemption. The federal government does not occupy the entire field. Ohio, for decades before the federal government was regulating accessibility and housing, it's not impossible to comply with both statutes, and it is contrary to the lower court's decision, Ohio's contribution statute does not create an obstacle to the purposes of the federal law. The purpose of the FHA is to provide fair housing throughout the entire country. And to reach this purpose, all participants in the process, the designers, the developers, and even the people that manage the properties, are held accountable under the FHA to ensure compliance. Contribution furthers this goal, not hinders it, because it ensures that everyone in that process can and will be held accountable. And in fact, not allowing contribution defeats the purposes of the FHA because it gives protection to people like the defendants here who violate the law. So it's the appellant's position that there is nothing within the within the FHA that would preempt the state contribution statute, and indeed it furthers the goal of the FHA to allow contribution, and so this court should reverse the 10th District's decision. Going on to the alternative grounds, I'd like to address first the single indivisible injury argument. In that case, or in that instance, the defendants are trying to say that we have not alleged a single indivisible injury. That is not true. Ohio's contribution statute requires that when two or more persons are jointly and severally liable in tort for the same injury, they can be held proportionately liable. And I would refer this court to its prior decision in the motorist mutual case. There we had a scenario where there was a driver who caused an accident. The individual who was not at fault was taken to two different hospitals where he received negligent treatment. Unfortunately, that individual passed away. The estate sued the driver and the insurance paid a settlement. The insurance company then attempted to get, in that case, actually indemnification from the individual doctors and medical providers, but this court said no, the appropriate analysis is the contribution statute, because you had two different negligences. You had the negligence of the driver combined with the negligence of the medical providers to create one injury, the death of the individual. And so this court said that the contribution statute would apply. Motorists didn't actually meet the requirements, particularly the statute of limitations, so they didn't have a claim. But that's not the case here. But if we look at our allegations, we've alleged a single injury. The injury is designing and constructing inaccessible housing. And EPCON had a role in this. They provided plans, they provided architectural prototypes, they provided sample site guidelines, and they provided generic provisions for the exteriors. Then defendants took those guidelines and generic site samples and built the community. So everyone in this process should be held accountable, can be held accountable, and there is one single injury, the alleged inaccessible housing. And moving on to whether housing discrimination.
So resolve this case through, I guess, some kind of agreement with the federal government. Was it a consent decree or what? How was it? What was the, was it a settlement? Is that what it was?
It was a settlement, Your Honor.
Okay, one of the arguments we hear is, well, it would defeat the purposes of the act if EPCON didn't pay the full amount. Is there anything that precluded the government from having a condition of that agreement that EPCON would pay the full amount? Could they have done that if they wanted to? I mean, is that something the parties could have negotiated for?
Your Honor, the EPCON has paid the full amount.
I understand, but is there anything that would have precluded the federal government from saying you're going to pay the full amount and you can't seek contribution from anyone else if they want to accomplish that?
They could have put that in the settlement agreement. EPCON would not have agreed to that, so we wouldn't have probably settled that case then. But there would have been nothing to prohibit that from the settlement agreement. But the statute, which is the question here, does not preempt allowing contribution. And so we're only looking at the statute, and the statute allows contribution claims, Your Honor.
Going back to the preemption argument, the 10th District cited the Volkswagen case and essentially started out with quoting extensively from that case, the three situations where federal law would preempt state law. One would be express preemption, which isn't in the statute. Another would be it occupies the entire field, which it doesn't since there's an Ohio statute, and where there's a conflict between federal law and state law. Is there any conflict between the federal statute and the state statute?
Not at all, Your Honor. Because allowing contribution furthers the goals of the FHA. The goal is that everyone in the process is cognizant of the rules of providing accessible housing, and that everyone does provide accessible housing. So contribution requires that everyone take part in that. And it says that if I'm liable for X, Y, and Z of the inaccessible housing, I can't pass that off to someone else. But the other person who's responsible for other portions of the inaccessible housing, they can't require that I pay 100% of it. So it makes sure that everyone in the process is aware of their requirements and follows those requirements. And so that's why it doesn't conflict, and that's why the court below was wrong. And I would refer this court to the Los Angeles case out of the Ninth Circuit, where they set forth exactly why, preemption does not conflict with disability laws, particularly regarding accessible buildings and housing.
Thank you.
With regard to the other alternative ground, real quickly, housing discrimination is a court, I would just say at the moment that every single court, including the United States Supreme Court, this court, and the federal circuit courts have held that housing discrimination statutes are torts. There is no case holding that they're not torts, and every single one has said that they are. And I think this court could decide that issue solely on the plethora of cases out there that support that. And lastly, a defendant's citation to the Northwest Airlines line of cases, as we said in our brief, has no bearing on this. The Northwest Airline case is related to whether there's an implied federal right of action. We're not raising a federal right of action for contribution here. We raise a single claim for state contribution under Ohio statute. And defendants rely on a single case, the Miami Valley case, which was a magistrate decision from the Southern District of Ohio that was overturned by the Sixth Circuit for the very reason we're saying here, that the analysis of whether there's an implied federal right is a separate and distinct analysis from whether the federal law preempts Ohio's law. And so we're not raising a federal claim. There's no de facto federal claim, and that whole line of casing is completely irrelevant to this court's analysis. And if there is no more questions, I'd like to reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Little.
Chief Justice Kennedy, honored members of this court, let me clarify one subject, if I may. And that's the suggestion that we would not support the 10th District's position. If the issue had been properly framed to the 10th District, if it had been properly submitted as part of the case, I think that at the conclusion of this matter, we would conclude that the 10th District was correct, that based upon the allegations advanced by the plaintiff in this case, not some other case, but the allegations in this particular case, preemption was available. And in fact, the 10th District cited no less than two decisions that expressly said, in this exact context under the FHA, that contribution claims under state law are preempted. We did not advance that argument. I submit to you that it's premature to do so, and there are for two reasons. One of them is legal, the second is practical. The first reason is that we have the teachings from the United States Supreme Court that says when you're resolving issues of supremacy clause, you must in the first instance determine whether or not there's a conflict. And we've sort of put the proverbial cart before the horse here because we want to talk about preemption, which we shouldn't, because we haven't resolved the first issue, whether there's a right under state law to advance this claim in the first instance. The second reason, the practical reason, why we elected not to bring that particular defense at the motion to dismiss stage is that often the preemption cases are very factually intensive. You have to look at specifically what is the claim being advanced. And as you saw in this case, once we filed one motion to dismiss, they filed an amended complaint. Our approach would have been to take discovery, more specifically frame their claims and then present the preemption. So that's why, as a practical matter, both legally and practically,
we didn't advance it. This is purely a legal question here, right? This is a question: is there a right to preemption under the Federal Housing Act? There's no discovery. There's no facts. I mean, that's purely a matter of law.
I disagree.
What possible facts could mean? Either there is or there isn't, right? It's a federal statute. Preemption doesn't work in some cases and not in others. Either it preempts all claims or it doesn't.
Well, when you look at the preemption analysis in this particular context under the FHA, the courts talk about deferring issues until summary judgment because they want to have a fuller understanding of the specific claim. So take, for example, in this case, their core argument is that under the contract, the franchisor agreement, that we assume certain responsibilities, i.e. that they delegated certain responsibilities. If they delegated responsibilities to us, well, all of a sudden, we're in a preemption zone. That's what the courts would say. If you're talking about where one party preempts certain obligations to the other, and then you're trying to then say that the party that delegated it had no liability, well, that's going to be a preemption argument. And there's plenty of case law in that particular context. Also, what they've said here is that we've breached a contract because we did not perform pursuant to the agreement. Well, that sounds more like an indemnification claim. And if it's an indemnification claim, then that is, as a matter of law, preempted because there's a settled body of case law across the country that says in the FHA context, a state law indemnification claim, a state law delegation claim, those are all preempted. So, Your Honor, that's why you would try to focus, get them pinned down on the specifics of their claims.
But we're now at the point where that train's kind of left the station. The Court of Appeals already issued its decision. So
I don't disagree that it was premature for the 10th District to reach that conclusion. And I don't think there's any difficulty with this court saying the 10th District should not have considered that issue, and that decision can be vacated. That resolves that issue. We don't have to dwell on the subject of preemption because there's a simple solution. Because then under the Supreme Court's teachings, we have to go back to the core issue, which is there a right of contribution in the first place? Now, the first minute they stood up here, counsel says, we're talking about equity. It has nothing to do with equity.
So the trial court sua sponte dismissed the action, and you indicated that you really couldn't get into the argument that you're positing now, which is that you have to determine first whether you've got the ability to proceed under state law. So we had a final appealable order. The Court of Appeals ruled on the preemption issue, but you think that the preemption issue really isn't the meat and potatoes here, that you should really get to the action where they're seeking the contribution from Wilcox, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. Although the trial court didn't sua sponte dismiss it, we filed a motion to dismiss. We advanced the argument there was no right of contribution under state law that was available. We also noted that there was no right of contribution under the FHA itself. And the trial court addressed one of those two arguments. The trial court agreed that there was no right of contribution under the FHA statute itself. It didn't specifically address the first argument. And then when it was then presented to the 10th District by the appellant, they interjected the concepts of preemption, and then, as someone's used the phrase, the train had left the station at that point in time the 10th District addressed the issue of preemption. But again, we jumped ahead in terms of what the required constitutional analysis is, which is, do you have a right of contribution in the first place? And they want to talk about concepts of equity. It's not equity. We know that at common law, there wasn't a common law right of contribution, whether we called it at law or in equity.
Except
we know that we have a statute, and the statute's going to dictate what rights they have.
I think, but they're arguing this is tort law, not contract law.
I know to what they argue, but if you look at the complaint, we know that the court doesn't accept counsel's characterizations of the complaint. We don't accept legal conclusions. We have to look at the meat of what they specifically alleged. And when you review the allegations of the complaint, they are very clear. They set forth these are the tasks that they, as the franchisor, performed. And then they've identified those tasks that were supposedly the obligation of the franchisee. And they're very specific in how they define those and delineate them in the complaint. In fact, we don't have to guess. There's a franchise agreement that lays out those different responsibilities. That's why it's not...
Help me, what are you asking us to do here? Are you asking us to vacate the preemption finding and send it back to the trial court?
No, Your Honor. I'm asking the court to affirm the 10th District. You can vacate the portion as to the preemption, but you should affirm it because, again, as we've outlined in the brief, this court's teachings are that if you can affirm the lower court, even for a reason that it did not articulate, you should do so.
Well, but we also have principles that say that we don't consider issues that we didn't accept. We have principles that say that decision-making is better when we have the benefit of a record on that issue in the lower court. So why wouldn't we just send it? Why wouldn't we just, if we agree with your opponent, why wouldn't we just say no, the court was wrong about preemption, and send it back to the trial court to figure out everything else?
Yep. I think I hopefully have an answer to the court's satisfaction on that. The first portion of that answer is that when you conduct a preemption analysis and they've asked the court to consider preemption, necessarily, under U.S. Supreme Court case law, you look to see whether there is a statute or a law in controversy. So that is simply part of the preemption analysis. So this issue has been, in fact, properly preserved and presented to this court. Second, as it relates to whether or not the court has the benefit of the party's briefing on this particular subject, well, you have the amended complaint and you have all the parties' briefing on that particular issue. The issue of whether or not there is any right of contribution under the Ohio tort statute has been fully briefed and exhausted by the parties before this court in their briefs. And as you've probably and hopefully concluded, you've seen that what they're arguing is that there's distinct obligations that the parties had. Well, if there's distinct obligations, distinct responsibilities for a particular category of elements for the construction of a program, it's not indivisible, it's divisible. And that it's divisible, then there cannot be a claim for joint and several liability. So their own complaint betrays them. Again, ignore the conclusions, ignore the labels, but you look to see what they've argued. They've conceded throughout their papers that the parties had different roles, different assignments, and they may argue that there was something wrong with the building. Well, the building doesn't simply implode. You could say that there was something wrong with the grade of the sidewalk. You could say there was something wrong with the height of the doorknob going into a particular building. Those are all specific, different, discrete assignments according to the plaintiff in its complaint. There is no joint and several liability that would give rise to a claim under the contribution statute. More fundamentally, their theory is that there had to be a tort, that the FHA is a tort statute. And counsel makes the representation that they've cited all these cases that support that notion. Your Honor, they've cited selective quotes from those decisions, but each of the cases that they cited in their opening brief, we went through very specifically and explained why the courts made no finding that the FHA was a tort statute or gave rise to a tort claim. It's simply a statute. And that statute sets forth duties, that statute creates liability, that statute establishes a remedy. It does not create a tort under Ohio law. It does not give rise to a common law claim under Ohio law. And in fact, they cited some additional cases in the reply brief.
What makes something a tort then?
Well, there is a common definition of tort that we have cited for the court. But what they've tried to describe it as is a statutory tort. And a tort, we would describe it as something that would arise as a matter of common law.
So nothing created by statute can be a tort?
There have been some federal statutes that have been viewed as statutory torts. They've used that term, but it's a different term than in the context of the contribution statute, which addresses torts arising under common law. That's the Ohio statute.
There's nothing that says torts arising under common law in that statute.
I'm sorry.
There's nothing in the contribution statute that uses the words common law.
That much is true, but we know that what the meaning of, we know how that statute's been applied. We know the genesis of that particular statute, which was to address the common law tort claims, whether they were medical malpractice, et cetera. So there's a long history of decisions from this court as to the origins of the Ohio contribution statute. It was not designed to create a mechanism for a contribution or reallocation of liability for a federal claim. And that's really the irony, because let's set the table of where these folks were at. After negotiating with the feds for a significant period of time, the feds sue the franchisor, no one else. And the negotiations are only between those two. And understand, the franchisor is not an owner. So yes, there's a liability for an owner of a building. Feds didn't go after the owner. They simply went after the designer of the plans. And then the franchisee could have, if they thought it was someone else's responsibility for their liability, filed third-party dissent under Rule 14, or Civil Rule 14. They elected not to do so. That would have been the mechanism.
Well, this was an administrative proceeding.
It went into federal court, Chair.
All right, okay.
That would have been the mechanism. So if they're going to stand before the court today like they are and say, that's not our liability, that's the liability of the franchisee, there was a mechanism for doing so. That was the proper mechanism for doing so. What they can't do after the fact is say, well, we went ahead and settled. We failed to join you in, but we really think these are your liabilities, because that's what they said in their papers. These are your liabilities. If there are liabilities, they're not joint several liabilities. Sometimes the best thing you can say is nothing. So if the court doesn't have any further questions,
Just one follow-up. The Ohio statute can exist without the FHA statute. And if there's a tort, and we can have differences of opinion of whether or not a tort occurred, but if we can fairly characterize the violation as a tort, I'm not sure why, even going back to your argument about the trial court not addressing whether we should even be dealing with the state law in the first place, doesn't that tort stand alone? And we really don't need to get to the preemption issue to decide whether or not they can seek contribution from you?
I think I understand the question. You're asking whether or not the franchisor has a tort claim against the franchisee?
Correct.
I don't believe so. So there's no tort liability that we would have. The liability, and this is what's really underlying the allegations and complaint, is really a contractual claim, which would then feed back into a preemption analysis if we ever got to that point. But I don't think we get there, Your Honor, because under their theory, every federal statute that gave rise to liability, whether it's Title VII or anything else, all of a sudden constitutes a tort, and that would give rise to a right of contribution under the statute. And I think you've seen from the lack of authorities cited in the papers, that's not how that statute has been treated.
Thank you.
Anything else? Thank you for your attention today.
Thank you, Your Honor. To start, I would say that the preemption issue is not premature, and it is a legal issue, not a factual issue. We alleged a single claim for contribution under Ohio statute. We did not allege a breach of contract claim. We haven't said that we've delegated any authority or any responsibility over to the defendants. What we're saying is both parties had liability, and EPCON paid more than its fair share of the responsibility for the alleged housing violations.
So why not bring them into the federal suit?
Because we didn't have to, Your Honor. It was an administrative proceeding starting off. We reached a settlement, And it then got filed in federal court to enact that settlement. And Ohio's contribution statute specifically provides what must be included in that settlement to be able to seek contribution after a settlement. So the statute itself contemplates settlement without bringing in the third parties under those provisions.
So you essentially negotiated a consent decree, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
Thank you.
And we met all of the requirements under the contribution statute for that settlement to be able to seek contribution now. And they don't argue otherwise. Furthermore, if you look at the Court of Appeals, all the decisions that they cited that the defendants are saying support finding preemption, none of those cases actually dealt with a preemption or with a contribution issue. All but one dealt with indemnification or de facto indemnification because they were seeking the entire liability. They weren't seeking proportional like EPCON is. In the one case, the Dawn case, there was no state contribution allowed. The state didn't have a contribution statute or a contribution claim, so you couldn't raise it. And so there is no case that actually has a real contribution claim in state law that has found that it is preempted. And reverse is true, though, that we have cases, the Shaw case cited in our brief, that has specifically found that the state law is not preempted for the reasons that we have raised. With regard to the single injury, this court has made clear under the motorist vehicle case that you can have different roles at different times and it's still the same injury. If a doctor and a driver can be both contributory or concurrently negligent and can be found to be under the contribution statute, those are two separate negligences at two separate times, but this court said contribution statute applies, then the same is here where EPCON did the planning or the designing and the defendants did the building. That is no different than the motorist vehicle case. And as to whether this is a tort, there are a number of statutory torts. This court even recognized in the Jenkins case cited in our brief that there are state statutory law. And a tort, Your Honors, is, sorry, when you have different, you can have a duty to someone else that is applicably applied, and there's a remedy. And that's exactly what the defendant said the FHA did. They said there's a statute that sets forth duties, it creates liability, and it provides a remedy. Therefore, it's our position that that meets the definition of a tort, and even if it's in a statute, it can still, the contribution statute can still apply and does apply, and therefore this court should reverse the entirety of the 10th District's decision and remand to the lower courts. If there's no other questions, I would.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Your Honor.
We will take the matter under advisement. You will receive a decision from the court. Marshall, would you please call a recess of the court?